What's up? This is Marv Ellis. You are listening.
Talk is cheap on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at KEPW.org. All right, today, second half of Nathaniel Brandon, Ayn Rand's lover. For those of you who didn't know, yes, Ayn Rand was a cougar. She was doing the horizontal bop with a man half her age back in the day. And then he had a falling out and did his own thing. So this is the second half of that. And then I will give you my critique of objectivism. And also, you know, go to your favorite band's website. I just heard on KBOO that Joni Mitchell just came out with a released a box set that has stuff from her playing in lounges, like has stuff from when she first started. And anything you can do to get out of the corporate record companies is great. So King Crimson, I've missed out. They reformed with and started doing their stuff from their third album from way back. So I sent away and got the CD, and this is from Discipline Global Mobile, and let me just read this to you. The phonographic copyright in these performances is operated by Discipline Global Mobile on behalf of the artists with whom it resides. Contrary to common practice in the record industry, Discipline accepts no reason for artists to assign the copyright interests in their work to either record company or management by virtue of a common practice which was always questionable, often improper, and is now indefensible. So I'll read that to you again. That's what Robert Fripp is doing to get the copyright and the money to the artist rather than the record company. So a little bit more on that, and I'll play you some stuff from that's just just mind-blowing. If you're into King Crimson, just I'm just over the moon on this. And, yeah, so I'll play you that at the end. So coming up, Nathaniel Brandon, Ayn Rand's young lover from 2002, probably back in Los Angeles. And yeah, my critique of objectivism coming up here on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Also streaming online at kpw.org. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media. Okay. The show's Talk is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ SusD. All right, so let's get to it here. So objectivism is Ayn Rand's philosophy that she came up with, that she came out with, that ended up getting a cult following. And by the way, none of the opinions on this show are that of KPW or Peaceworks or any of the producers or DJs here or anybody affiliated with KEPW. So, and today they're mine. I try not to give you opinions. I try to play you stuff of other people. But I had this tape and it was, it's a little over an hour. So I split it into two parts and that gives me a chance to do some ranting. All right. So objective truth is like Aristotle said that A is A. And, you know, this has been a problem because, for instance, people used to think that the sun revolved around the earth because – and this was – and this goes a little bit – is related to the what Robert Fripp is saying about common practice. There was common knowledge back then. You know, this is the danger of common sense. Sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad, though. Common sense tells you that the earth – that the sun revolves around the earth because that's what you observe in the sky. Well, when new instruments are discovered and new information is discovered, then that the truth changes. So, but there's a physical truth like that, like the, you know, the universe and stars, but even that changes. We thought, I just heard that they, I meant to look this up. They just discovered dark matter where all the missing dark matter was. So as soon as they find an instrument that can measure this stuff, then they change what the truth is. They thought that there wasn't enough, that there was too much dark matter in the universe, or however that goes. Anyway, under objectivism, it got a big following, including Alan Greenspan. And here's an example of Alan Greenspan. I got to say, he stuck to his objectivist origins and didn't raise interest rates. Because he knew that the truth was that it didn't, that interest rates didn't need to be raised, although and they never really need to be raised. And if you are frequent listeners of this show, I'm not going to go into my spiel on the Federal Reserve and the central bank. Whereas Volcker raised the interest rates to 21% on a theory that this lowers inflation, which it's questionable whether that has ever worked. So at least Greenspan, for him, I will say for him, he came out and didn't raise interest rates. But, you know, they always trotted out Greenspan. He had this what's known as Fed speak. Every time the Federal Reserve screwed up, they would trot out Alan Greenspan, and he would just basically say gibberish to cover up what that the Fed has no idea what they're doing and has no real power. Or they have incredible power, but they rarely do the right thing. And usually do the wrong thing and send the economy into a spiral. Luckily, right now, they've had sense enough to keep the interest rates down. Okay, so this is what I'm saying is the truth is not always – there's physical truth, but there's also – but like in – we have this constant debate in journalism, in the news, of what is truth. And there's a concept called journalistic integrity – where there's a concept called truthfulness in journalistic integrity. And the truth is the truth until they find new information. And then it ceases to be the truth anymore. The classic example is the Pentagon Papers. You know, everyone thought we were winning the war in Vietnam. And then the Pentagon Papers come out, and not only are we not winning the war, it's a complete waste of time and money and bodies. So, yeah, and then, you know, I'll give you another example, and this is all my own stuff here, so whatever. Please use your own brain at all times, research this stuff yourself. Look at Walter Cronkite. They trot him out all the time as Mr. Integrity of Journalist Integrity, and he's always going to give you the truth. Well, all of these correspondents, every single one, every one news anchor was a war correspondent. Wolf Blitzer, all these guys got their start as a war correspondent. Well, you know, and just as an aside too, Walter Cronkite, you know, he cried when Kennedy died. Well, technically, that is not objective. You know, of course, the guy's not a robot. Of course, he's going to cry when you lose someone important and special. However, that is not being objective when you do that. So anyway, when all these are war correspondents, and I just read a few months ago about Martha Gellhorn's autobiography, where she talks about the Spanish Civil War. And, you know, war correspondents have always, now they're embedded, but they're never taken to where the war is, to where they're getting real information. And Martha Gellhorn and Ernest Hemingway and George Orwell during the Spanish Civil War had to cheat, you know, had to pay somebody to take them to see what was really going on against, you know, Franco. She almost got caught by Franco and all that stuff. So, you know, a war correspondent is really only giving you the information that they're getting, that the military allows out of the war. So even Walter Cronkite is not really objective. These areas are not really objective until the truth, until you get more information. So this is where my argument is always that it's up to the listener to seek diverse, the consumer of news to seek diverse sources. And that's what I try to give you here, and I encourage you to go get diverse sources. And so finally, what I'd like to say is my own criteria for the news, and many news analysts agree with me, Jeff Cohen, Norman Solomon, all the liberal news analysts are saying, what the news is supposed to be, how am I better after hearing the news? And including, if the news just pits you against someone, that is not helpful. Even the and context to me is everything. You don't report on the Middle East without talking about weapons sales and oil. That's taking it out of context. You don't report on and this is going to piss everybody off. Even the Proud Boys and the neo-Nazis. When you're reporting about them and you're not explaining, you're not taking the time to explain that they are a result of economic problems, and even going back into the Nazis in the First World War and the Second World War, it was caused by a huge recession that the aristocrats made the German middle class pay for a war that was between aristocrats. The World War I was basically a war between aristocrats, and you've heard me say this before, regular listeners. So reporting on just talking about and pitting people against each other without getting to the underlying causes of why these people are doing that, even as wrong as they are, there's a reason that they're doing this. And there's a reason that the Nazis came to power was because of economic reasons. So anytime you're reporting, they're reporting stuff and you don't hear the context that it's happening. The other one is the Iraq war, you know. To sell weapons, you know, they said there was curveball. They got all this information from curveball. And, you know, they said that the incubators that babies were being killed in incubators, and all that was completely false. And then, so there's the truth was turned out to be completely false, and we went to a major war. And then Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, the head of the Intelligence Committee, did not investigate George W. Bush for getting us into a $1 trillion war for no reason and spending trillions of dollars, not including the money they lost on the Iraq war. And none of this was investigated. So whether you're liberal or conservative, the truth is subjective, believe it or not. So there's where Ayn Rand is wrong. And, you know, Ayn Rand, I said in the last episode, in last week, that she got all information from the New York Times in the latter part of her life. And she selected history, chunks of history. And this is why the truth for her, the objective truth for her, was actually subjective. It was subjective to her where she was getting her information and the sampling of her information, how it was sampled. All right, so I'm going to go right into Nathaniel Brandon. This tape's going to end, and I'm going to turn it over, and I'm going to do all that without a musical break, and then we'll get into King Crimson and some really mind-blowing music that is non-corporate music from Discipline Global Mobile. So, yeah, support your favorite artist. Go to their website. You'd be surprised what you're going to find on there, hopefully out of the corporate music world. Okay, so here's Nathaniel Brandon, recorded in Los Angeles in 2002.
Green shirt.
Yes, in Atlas Shrugged and in the Fountainhead, the main characters, I have the initials HR, Robert Rourke and Hank Reardon. Who's HR?
You know what's funny? I remember that very well. Ian herself was totally unaware of it until somebody pointed it out to her. Totally unconscious. Because I remember when she got, somehow somebody drew it to her attention and she was quite taken aback. She had not been aware of it. Yes, sir.
What was there in her central core philosophy and yours that changed you from colleague to adversary?
It didn't happen philosophically. It happened when I fell in love with another woman.
But there is a difference. Still.
Yes. Yeah, but it wasn't. I didn't know it consciously yet. It was going to take me several years to think it all through. At that time, I would have said, no, our differences are not exactly philosophical, but they were certainly personal. She was quite a controlling person, and the older I got, the less tolerable that became also. That which was acceptable when I was 24 would be much less acceptable when I was 34, and so on. I'm sure you can understand that. Yeah, the yellow shirt that I see?
Yeah, this is a little different, a little off of what you're talking about, but multinational corporations are the robber barons of our day. Would she still, do you think she would still advocate, though I'm using the wrong words, would she still be a proponent of multinational corporations? Especially where free enterprise is, they tend to restrict free enterprise and free trade?
Well, to begin with, she would never accept as correct the designation of robber barons. If you're talking first, to begin with, when the term was originally used, of course, as a criticism of 19th century industrialism. Because until they came on the scene, who had the wealth that they robbed? The wealth didn't exist. It had to be produced by somebody. Okay, now, with regard to multinational corporations, insofar as they would depart from principles of free trade and free market, she would be very vigorously opposed to them. In fact, I once kidded her, and I think I tell this story in my book. I said to her, you know, I ought to write an article called Big Business versus Capitalism. Will that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Yes, sir.
If you could live your life differently, what would you do?
I do live my life differently. I don't understand the question, actually. That was just a joke. What do you mean if I could live my life differently?
If you could go back and make different decisions than you made.
Oh. I would have, when I realized that I had made a mistake in initiating this kind of transitioning from a friend into a lover, when I realized this really was not the kind of relationship I wanted with her, I would have had the wisdom and the courage to tell her so plainly and deal with whatever was going to happen then. So I would have been more forthright in my communications with her. That's number one. Number two, best case scenario, I still would have left much younger than 38. Because in order for me to find my own path, I needed to be outside that context. And I would have seen that, and I would have liked to have been able to bring things off in a far more benevolent way, which I know would have been quite impossible. But I would at least know I had made a serious attempt. There are other different choices I would make, but they don't bear upon this issue, so I'm just answering them within the context of that relationship and that story. Okay? Thank you. Yes?
When you read her view of Ayn Rand, was that the Ayn Rand that you knew, or was there anything you disagreed with?
When I read Barbara Brand's biography of, well, I think that the portrait of Ayn Rand in Barbara's book and the portrait of Ayn Rand in my book are not different in any very important ways. I think they pretty much convey... There are some differences in the stories we tell and what incidents we chose to select to characterize her. But I don't see any radical differences. Well, that's completely true, and I would certainly support her on that. In fact, it might be more important for you to vote by me. Yes, sir.
You may comment on this documentary that was done on Ayn Rand, A Sense of Life. If you have any comments on that.
Sure. What I enjoyed most about the documentary on Ayn Rand, A Sense of Life, I loved all the photographs from her childhood, which I had not seen. And I found all the pictures of her young life in Russia and all, or in America, very, very interesting. It was hopelessly over-adulatory. I mean, one felt absolutely zero distance between the director and the writer and their subject. So there was absolutely no sense of objectivity about anything. And I thought the attempt to briefly run past the Rand-Brandon relationship was so ludicrous that it was just funny beyond words, because they really, you know how in the Soviet Union they kept rewriting history, removing people from photographs and, you know, changing history well, the same thing, major effort was made and still goes on being made to establish that there never was a Nathaniel Brandon. He's only a figment of my imagination. And so Leonard Peikoff, the heir and the standard bearer now, permitted himself to say, well, you know, I guess she must have liked him. Knowing that he's talking about a woman with whom, who had an affair with me, who dedicated Atlas Shrugged to me, and then she, 2 million copies later, removed it. So I guess she must have liked me, is kind of ludicrous. And his attempts to explain any of it psychologically are just plain silly. So they had it difficult. They didn't want to look at the fact I created the objectivist movement. So if you're telling that story, you have a nickel's worth of honesty in your makeup, that fact has to be acknowledged. When I launched the Nathaniel Brandon Institute to teach her philosophy in 1958, up until that time, she was a novelist in public perception.
I brought that up on the radio show.
You did?
I did.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
What are your differences with her philosophy today?
What are my differences? Well, the biggest differences in my philosophy with Ayn Rand probably are in the field of psychology. I have to tell you that I disagree with almost everything she ever said or wrote about why people behave as they do. Of her psychological explanations, I disagree almost 100%, with very rare exceptions. I think that her ethics, while profound, is very incomplete. Because the truth, it doesn't remotely deal in enough depth with the ethical issues that arise in human relationships. There's much, much more to ethics than the issue of whether or not one should sacrifice oneself. There's all sorts of very complex moral decision-making issues that can arise. You would never gather from her treatment that almost all of the goals that we pursue today require the cooperation and collaboration of a great many people to get done. And therefore, how to deal with people effectively is a very important, not a trivial, skill that's largely neglected by her. Also, if you want to write a great statement on ethics, a glaring omission is any story of moral redemption. You need to show, since people in fact do at times, everybody sooner or later does some things which are wrong, and which they know at some level are wrong, you need to show a person who has done things, not just errors of knowledge, but errors of morality, and climb back up and out. The only tiny example of that in Atlas Shrugged is the character nicknamed the Wet Nurse. And the first time he tries to act with integrity, he gets killed. So it's hardly an inspiring ethical message. Finally, although I'm not a mystic, what I know today and didn't know back then was that Ayn Rand knew nothing about mysticism, and that her whole analysis of the psychology of mysticism in Gall's Speech is preposterous to anybody who knows or studied any serious mystical literature. That it's not about what she says it's about. It's much more complex. Serious mystics have as much contempt for, quote, whims or blindly following feelings as she would ever have. She had a very narrow take of a very primitive Greek Orthodox mysticism in Russia, and she generalized from that to all mystical religious traditions. It's just not, it showed a really lack of scholarship. For those of you who might be interested in my own views on spirituality and mysticism, I recommend a book of mine, which is one of my great loves, a book called The Art of Living Consciously. Anything else? Yes, sir.
I know this is an in-depth question, but what are the most important things people can do to build their self-esteem?
What are the most important things that people can do to build their self-esteem? Here are the six pillars of self-esteem. Now in 15 foreign languages, but here it is in English, okay? One, the practice of living consciously. Two, the practice of self-acceptance. Three, the practice of self-responsibility. Four, the practice of self-assertiveness. Five, the practice of living purposefully. Six, the practice of personal integrity. That's headline answer. But I would say, if I only could say one thing, learn to operate more self-responsibly. Learn that there's absolutely no profit in blaming, alibying, or waiting to be rescued, because no one is coming. If you don't, get it through your head that if you don't do something different, nothing is going to get better. And if I could tell people only one thing about how to grow as a human being, how to get more control over your life, is to take responsibility for achieving whatever results you want. Get off of thinking like a victim. There's no reward. Yeah.
In reading Ayn Rand's books, originally I got the impression that she was probably an atheist, sort of believed that you live in your body, you die, your consciousness ceases. But I got the feeling near some close death scenes of some of the characters in her books that she assumed consciousness continued.
What? She assumed what?
That consciousness would continue through past death, only because of the certain. I got that impression.
I can't imagine how, because she, I promise you, was an atheist and took her for granted that when life ends, that individual consciousness ends. A view I share, incidentally. But that's neither here nor there. Yes, I'll get you.
I'd like to ask you a question with all due respect to you, what your opinion is of Leonard Peikoff and the objectivist that now is representing her philosophy. What is your opinion of them as scholars of the philosophy? If you have any thoughts on that. I'm sure you do.
Ayn Rand appointed Leonard Peikoff, the youngest member of our circle, as her intellectual heir, as well as her financial heir. And he created the Ayn Rand Institute at Marina Del Rey, which is does a lot of very interesting work to propagate her philosophy, especially to get it into the universities, where they've had some quite impressive successes, I have to say. The biggest problem is they're absolutely committed get a proposition that Ayn Rand was an absolutely perfect human being, and that there are no errors of any kind in her thought, and no refinements or improvements that are needed in any of her thinking. And that they will not cooperate and make their archives available to scholars who don't share that conviction. So they have totally betrayed the essence of scholarship, which is respect for facts above all. For them, it's loyalty to Ayn Rand above all. It's keeper of the flame above all. And that can make intelligent people stupid, functionally. So it's not even an issue of whether or not these people have any brains. Of course they do. They're not stupid people. But they cannot be trusted because they have an agenda other than telling the truth. Yes?
Some years ago, you wrote a book called The Psychology of Romantic Love.
Yes.
If you were to revise that now, would you have any changes in that stuff?
Some years ago, I wrote a book called The Psychology of Romantic Love. If I were to revise it now, would I make any changes? Nothing I can think of off the bat. I can think of a lot of things I'd like to add. I'd make it twice as long if I were writing it today. But I can't remember anything in the book that I would disagree with today. I would it certainly wouldn't be anything major, or I'd remember it, but it would be a bigger book.
How about the psychology of self-esteem?
Oh, yeah, I've done that, yes. That,
I love that book.
Well, this is very interesting. You know, for many people, that, I've written 20 books, and for many people, that, of my readers, that remains their favorite. A new 31st anniversary edition is being published in a few months. It certainly is the foundation of all my later work, although I certainly grew, be damn strange if I didn't, in my understanding of self-esteem since I published that book in 1969. So if I hadn't learned anything new in 30 years, that would be embarrassing. But you could take its very basic intellectual structure and see in what sense it's still the frame of reference that supports the later work. Yes, sir. Who's heard?
I'm curious if you care to address this this thought that in today's hustle bustle, double working jobs, people lose their jobs. And for instance, in the Department of Water and Power, they're sort of a niche in city government. The people that work there, they're going to contract out. A lot of those people are going to be moved out to new jobs and sized down and moved out. Curiosity is, how would you address the loss of an identity that is involved with a job?
Okay, the gentleman talks about the fact that he mentions the Department of Water and Power, but of course it could have applied to any number of where people downsize or they outsource, and you may lose a job that you've held for a long time. And he says, how, but the question is very important.
KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works, Community Radio, also simulcast on KEPW.org. Listening to Nathaniel Brandon, Ayn Rand's Young Lover. And here's the tape turned over. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends.
The job you're doing in the first place. Because never tie your identity to that which other people's decisions can take away from you. I remember many years ago I was doing a self-esteem seminar in Detroit at a time when Washington was trying to decide whether or not to bail out Chrysler. You might remember the two, you know, to guarantee some loans that Chrysler needed at that time to weather their storms. And in the audience of this particular seminar were some Chrysler executives. And we've been talking about an issue sort of closely related, but not the same as, but closely enough related to your question to be worth mentioning. I was making the point, it's very understandable. Men in particular are socialized to identify, if not their identity, then their worth with being good providers, good family supporters, etc. But if you tie your self-esteem to that, it's potentially very tragic. I said, look, right now, you're waiting to find out whether or not government is going to, in effect, bail out Chrysler. That means that if your self-esteem is tied to your paycheck of this week, literally, or next week, your soul is now in the hands of some people in Washington you don't even know. Does that offend you? I hope it does. It offends me, I said. And you see how that relates? So that in a better world to come, when what I teach will be taught in grade school, I'm not joking, will be very much discouraging people from basing their self-esteem on that which somebody else's decision can take away from you. Thank you.
Might I focus just a little bit more in terms of the city and the county both did studies a while back on self-esteem.
Right.
And in talking about that, they addressed the minority areas of the city whose self-esteem needed to be raised in order to compete equally. And in a sense, the self-esteem comes very contemporary in terms of acting out the Columbine shootings and the issues regarding the fellow that went over to the stock market group that blew up some of the people that he felt were involved in his demise. So how would you address this specifically from the point of view of these events occurring and seeming to have some sense of interrelatedness with self-esteem?
Okay.
Even to the extent that the city and the county governments identify this as an area of problem.
I'm trying to think how to answer you without using bad language. Because the city council and the government doesn't know blank blank about self-esteem. All right? And their efforts to support it or protect it are blank blank. Allow me to answer you. All right? So, because I began writing about self-esteem when almost nobody was, I got labeled the father of the self-esteem movement, and it was intended as a compliment. But like a parent or a grandparent who is hideously embarrassed by his children, I have very mixed feelings when I hear myself described in that way, because so much today is said in the name of self-esteem, which is nonsense. Like protecting children from knowing whether or not they know a subject or not, in case, God forbid, they should wound their egos to find out they can't add. You know, that kind of stuff. Or, self-esteem, if it's not in alignment with reality, it's not self-esteem, it's hallucination, whatever the hell it is, it's not self-esteem. This also is discussed by me in some detail in The Art of Living Consciously. Allow me to draw my line here and take another question. Thank you. Very interesting. Yes?
Yeah, I'm coming back with a question because my training is in sociology. When you left Enron, it was because she was too controlling, and 20 years later, but she was already a 55 or 60-year-old woman, an intellectual, not necessarily focused on putting herself beautiful every day. So how much of your moving away from her was also a part of the fact of being a male and being a visual creature when you relate to the female?
Which is that?
Well, first of all,
how much did her looks play?
I say that you were right in
his leaving her.
And that is that I wish I could say that I had the brains to break with her. I didn't. She broke with me. She broke with me when she found out I was in love with another woman. You understand? At that time, I was trying to, in my naivety, save the relationship but on a friendship basis. I mean, talk about not being too bright. But you understand? If the age difference hadn't been as it was, given her psychology of mine, whether it happened a year later or a year earlier, it would have ended. I don't know anybody who doesn't know us both who wouldn't agree with me. God knows I've talked to enough people about it in the last 31 years. Yes. Thank you.
I, like everybody else here, I was swept away by Atlas Shrugged at the age of 14. Everyone I talked to was swept away at the age of 14, and then when they're about 20, they kind of wake up as if they had been dreaming. And I was trying to be like in a trance, as if that she had hypnotized us.
Oh, yeah.
And I was trying to figure out what it was that made me so be so swept away, and I have a theory, and I was wondering if you agreed with me. Especially at that time, which was in the 50s and 60s, the whole world was emphasizing sacrificing yourself to others. And being a victim, like interacting as if they were a victim, and I had a, you know, and her, she was the opposite extreme. And so to be in a world where everybody is trying to get you to sacrifice and to the opposite extreme, in order to eventually get to the middle, she was a wonderful director.
This is a very interesting question, man. Let me give the essence of it to the group, because I don't think they all heard you. She says, like many people have read Ayn Rand when they're 14 or 15, and then when they hit, and they might fall in love with it and get very excited, that come 20, a process of disillusionment sets in. And she thought that that might be especially true during the 50s or 60s, when there was so much emphasis on self-sacrifice, and that maybe Rand was a very good counterbalance or corrective for that. Well, first of all, you're factually wrong that the typical first-time Ayn Rand reader is closer to 20 than to 14. 14 is very young to read her, okay? And number two, she's never sold more strongly than she is this week. Her sales, are incredible. Her content has been doing like 300,000 copies a year. You understand me? There are bestsellers just written last week that aren't selling 300,000 copies a year. So you can't tie it back to the history of the period. But I'll tell you what, perhaps the most relevant thing to say without tying it, whether you're 14 or 25 or whatever. People stumble often on the question of how to apply these ideals to the world in which they live. And for some people, I don't have a good explanation for this. For some people, it's not a complicated issue. And for others, it's a tremendously complicated issue. Part of the issue is that since she is very controversial, you may move in circles where you'll take a lot of heat from being an admirer of Ayn Rand. And don't kid yourself. That has caused a good many people to start backpedaling when they got older. But more broadly, most people don't, whether the ideals are Ayn Rand's ideals or somebody else's ideals, very few people, irrespective of the content of their philosophy, hold fast to the moral vision of their youth. Those who do are a minority. And that's true whether their particular vision is of a Randian kind or something very, very different. I've had the opportunity to know people quite across the intellectual spectrum. And they have certain things in common. So, this, I believe, is my understanding of why that phenomenon happened. You want to say something?
I love my youthful ideals, and what happened at the age of 20 was I met a neighbor who also had a 14, and he said that he's too simplistic, and that in dealing with relationships with people, her theory was very good, but on a political and religious scale, she was just very naive, and it was just too simple for the complications of the world.
Well, I understand.
It's not that I lost my ideals, it's just I got to see the world in a more full way. And she's
well, Yeah, right. I wonder whether you got to see the world in a more full way or you got to see the world in a more conventional way.
No, I got to see the world in a more compassionate way, and I always resented that she was so hard on Teddy in that first show. That really bothered me.
Hard on him?
Well, he's not a hero just because he's an ordinary person.
I don't have that interpretation of the character of Eddie Willers at all.
No, in fact, as time has gone on, I've become more and more compassionate.
Well, that's fine. I applaud that.
But I haven't lost my ideals at all. I've never been before. But I don't think that she's simplistic and inconsistent.
No more so than anybody else who attempts to encompass the universe in the book. You know... We have intelligence. We can think about... See, you mentioned naivety politically. Many of the things that she was teaching in the 1950s that people thought that's crazy and that's simplistic is now regarded as obviously true. This is the other side of the story. I'll give you some examples. In the 1950s, overwhelming number of intellectuals knew for a fact that communism was the wave of the future and that capitalism was on its last legs. Right. And that when I was going to UCLA as a kid, 1920, talking about capitalism, people thought I was crazy. To give you the feeling of the climate of the time, I was taking a government course, and a professor approached me and said, "The trouble with you, sir, young man, is you're just prejudiced against dictatorships." Prejudice. Now, I remember, I'll tell you just two fast stories. Number one, I'm 20 years old, it's not maybe 6 or 8 months after I met Rand, and I'm not yet the world authority on economics that I was to become a few years later. And I'm having a conversation with a guy who's a socialist. And he says, "You are so naive, you don't understand." I was in some context trying to explain how free trade operated and why it was desirable, not just internally but also internationally. He says, "You don't understand the real world." He points to the big three, Chrysler, Ford, and GM. And he says, for example, nobody can compete with these three, you know. They have a complete lock on the automobile market of the universe for all practical purposes. And nobody could compete with them. So what the hell kind of freedom is that? So I said, providing there are no laws forbidding people to compete with them, sooner or later, there will be competition. He says, "How?" I said, "Well, for example, I was making this up as I went along as a logical exercise. The year is 1950. But I was not stupid. I said, imagine that some foreign country, and we have international free trade, no tariffs, which we, of course, we would advocate, sees there's a missing hole that the American automobile industry is not addressing. They see a need or a market for a different kind of car. And if they're free to offer it for sale, if it's got something the others don't have, they will find a way to penetrate the American market." He said, "You crazy? A foreign country is going to, we're the king of the world of all things to imagine that somebody else could displace us in the automobile industry." Along came the Volkswagen, along came the Toyota, and the rest is history. But the point was, nobody could even imagine what I was talking about in 1950. In 1958 or 9, I'm giving a party in New York City, and one of the guests is Mike Wallace. And I am trying to explain to this group why she does not see the Soviet Union as a serious military threat to the U.S. She says we should stop helping indirectly socialist other countries, but left to their own devices, without any help from us, they are not a danger. They've got too many problems of their own. And she was trying to explain, she says, it's almost impossible to explain to an American the level of incompetence which is standard in the Soviet Union. It's totally outside, I remember her saying, an American's ability to grasp and therefore to believe. And she's elaborating on this for half an hour. I'm giving you the short version, obviously. So Mike takes me aside and he says, "You know, I love Ayn, but don't you think she's really blind on the subject of Soviet Union?" I says, "No, I don't." Okay, flash forward. in the late 1980s, Gorbachev was telling the world what Rand was telling in my house that night. But when she told it, he said, she's simplistic. She's naive. So she has been right about so many things. Do I think she's wrong about some things? Yes. But her record is nothing to sneeze at. I'll take one more question. Somebody hasn't asked a question yet. Are there any more fresh blood in the room? And then we'll call. Yes. Hi.
Hi. You made a statement, and correct me if I'm wrong. You made a statement a while back, like a year, maybe 2 years ago, at another lecture that you didn't think was critical to a person's character, whether they believed in God or not.
That's true.
You did make that statement. I'm just wondering, in the view of
that's what
my understanding of objectivism.
Right. Well, that's an area where Rand and I would disagree, of course.
Yeah.
And what I said, I'm trying to remember what book I said it. Oh, The Art of Living Consciously. I said this. When I was a younger man, I thought, theoretically, it should make a difference. But I found out empirically, if I just look at my experience without any preconceived notions, if all I knew about a person was that they said they believed in God, or they said they didn't believe in God, and if I knew nothing else, I could not predict anything about their behavior. Okay? It had no predictive value that I ever could discover. And that wasn't something I wanted to be true. I wanted a totally different reality to be true. But the truth of the matter was, that's how I saw things. So what it got me thinking about is that, first of all, you don't even know what the hell somebody means when they tell you they believe in God. If we sat down privately interviewed everybody who would now hear me, you might find 50 or 60 different concepts of what exactly G-O-D means. Okay? So, for some people, it's like an entertainment. It's a spiritual entertainment. And for others, it's something they live and breathe every day. So, there's so much more. So that's what my point there. If all you know is the profession of the belief and the disbelief, I have never been able to predict anything. Okay?
Does it make sense to you that at this point, this late in the 20th century, there is still such a dominant belief in God throughout the world?
I mean, sure. It's not a belief that I share.
It just seems to clash with science, with reason, with any common sense that to believe in.
No. To begin with, to answer you literally, you're taking for granted a level of knowledge about which 95% of the world knows nothing. If you want to talk numbers. You understand? Sitting here having a jolly chat in Borders in Santa Monica. We're already at a very high level. Irrespective of what we think about this particular... You understand me? I promise you that... Secondly, so long as people have a need to understand the world in which they live, and so long as there is so much we don't understand and can't even imagine about the nature of the universe, God for many people is profoundly satisfying.
All right, you've been listening to Nathaniel Brandon. Please use your own brain at all times. When listening to anybody. All right, so here's some King Crimson for you. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends.
Meadow, old night stalks by, broken plows hide, spokeless wheels in shadow. Sentries lean on, thornwood spears blow on their hands, stare eastward. Burnt with dream and taut with fear, dawn's misty shawl upon them. Three hills apart, great army stir, spit oath and curse as day breaks. Forming lines of horse and steel by even years.